Okay, let's start off with this, I think, a really interesting book by Jonathan Sacks. Of course, you know that he was the chief rabbi of Great Britain. And he wrote a whole series of books through the Torah. And this is just one of them, of course, but I thought the one on Leviticus would be really interesting to look at because we already looked with Rabbi Zev at a portion of Leviticus. And Leviticus is one of those books that just seems so, for most people, complicated, mixed up, that kind of stuff. And I think Rabbi Sacks really helps us to straighten out what are the flows of the themes in Leviticus. So, as usual, we'll just go through it a page at a time, and I'll comment on the things that I find interesting. And if you got something to add for those particular pages, please speak up so that we can all gain from each other's perspective. Okay, so I thought it was interesting that he starts on page one with this comment in the second paragraph. Little happens in Leviticus. It's so interesting because it's not a narrative book, right? There's not much narrative, and little that does exist is troubling. Two of Aaron's sons, Nadav and Abihu, die on the day of the consecration of the tabernacle, simply, it seems, because of an act of misplaced enthusiasm. Even when Leviticus speaks about ethics, it does so in a perplexing way. The great chapter 19, which we looked at before, with its majestic summons, "Be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy," mixes moral imperatives with ritual and seemingly irrational commands, like the prohibition against wearing clothes of mixed wool and linen, etc. That we've looked at some of those passages. But it just seems to me that it's a really good introduction to Leviticus to acknowledge how absolutely different it is from Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Right? It just doesn't seem to fit with those. Of course, it's part of the Mosaic Torah, and now we need to ask, okay, well, how come this really odd book is right in the middle of all of this? And I think his comments on the next couple of pages really help us to understand why Leviticus is placed where it is, okay? So on page two, he says, he's talking about the golden calf, and he says, it is Leviticus that forbids us to take vengeance or bear a grudge, take a stand against the psychopathology of hatred and violence. It contains one of the most remarkable of all religious ideas, that we are summoned to be holy because God is holy. Not only are we recreated in God's image, we are called to act God's ways. And of course, if you know anything about our previous studies in Genesis, that my argument is that the Genesis account for the creation of human beings is not about the physical, cognitive, emotional constituents of human being, but rather about the way that we act. We either act in God's ways or we don't. And to be human is to act in God's ways because his spirit is breathed into us. Okay? So Sacks is acknowledging that same idea that Leviticus is not going to be about the physical, material things that show up in an objective way in religious practice, but it's going to be about what happens when we have to act in a certain kind of way. And then he says over on page three, top of page three, despite the importance of the prophets to the religion of Israel, it is to the role of the priest, not prophet, that God summons our ancestors and summons us. The very name given by the tradition of the Mosaic books, Torah, is a priestly word. Of course, we understand Torah to be instruction, but now it's really interesting to recognize that Leviticus is really a book of instruction in the middle of the narrative on the transition from Egypt to the Promised Land, to Canaan. Okay? At the bottom of the page, same page, in the middle of the page it says, he's talking about, will be my argument that you can't understand Judaism without the priestly voice. Judaism, from the Torah onward, is a conversation scored for many voices. Why this is so, I'll explain below, but it is undeniable. It is this internal diversity, this complex harmony and occasional discord that gives Judaism its dynamism. Now, why is that so important? Because as he's going to argue later, Judaism is not actually a philosophy. It's a conversation. And because it's a conversation, it has all of this tension built into it. It has this disharmony right in the middle of it, right? So you can think of reading Leviticus as though you're listening in on a conversation between the people who've come out of Egypt. And, you know, and the result of that is, just like all conversations, there's going to be this mix back and forth. And because there is this mix back and forth, it shows you that the heart of Judaism, which is the instructions found in Leviticus, is really the heart of a people in conversation with God. Now, at the bottom of this same page, he says, the book of Leviticus is sustained meditation on what holiness is and how it can be translated into life, right? So now, this is really important, because we're not looking at Leviticus as though it's a set of rules, not one, you know, not a whole series of more commandments. It's really, as he says, a sustained meditation on what it means to be holy. So there's going to be a lot of discussion and conversation and tension in that process. So when we look at the book of Leviticus, we should expect to find these odd and unusual things that we have to noodle our way through, as we did with Rabbi Zev in the past, discovering, of course, like two fabrics might actually lead us all the way back to Egyptian funeral rites, right? And once we start to discover that, then we can see what's really happening when God seems to prohibit things that look like they're completely meaningless, right? But now we realize that this is a meditation and instruction about what it means to be holy to a people who've experienced the Exodus, okay? So one more comment on page 5. At the top of that page, he says, Rashi explains, he's talking about the tradition eventually came to call it by this first word, Vayikra, meaning he, God, called. Rashi explains that this is a term of endearment. Many of God's messages in the Torah are prefaced by the words he said, Vayomer, and he spoke, Vayada, okay? Or he commanded, Vayitzav. All three belong to the language of authority. God issues an order and that we must obey. But Vayikra, he called, summoned, beckoned, is a language of invitation, friendship, and love. Isn't that cool? Because when you think about it, we think of Leviticus as more commandments based on God's authority. You have to be holy because I was holy. But what's interesting is, as he points out in this really important quote, that Leviticus is based on the idea of a love call, a beckoning, a summoning, but not because of a supreme authority, but rather because it's an invitation to enter into this deep love relationship with God. I think it's so cool that when we think about Vayomer, Vadaber, all the other commandments, here Vayikra has a different tenor to it, right? Which I think will really help us when we get into the details of Leviticus to remember that we're not really looking at another set of commandments. We're really looking at, as Sack says, a meditation on what it means to love God. Okay? Please stop anytime you want to stop because I skipped something that you found insightful or because you want to add something. Just stop us and we will comment. And if not, we'll go to page 7. There's a whole lot of stuff on page 7. The last 1, 2, 3 paragraphs. What we have, in other words, he says, between Exodus 24 and Leviticus 25 is a massive parenthesis, some 40 chapters long, by far the longest of its kind in the Hebrew Bible. This was already noticed by the classical commentators, notably Ben Ezra and Nachmanides. It is a huge digression. So here comes the question. What caused it? Why is Leviticus stuck right in the middle of this narrative? There is only one plausible candidate, the episode of the golden calf. Coming so soon the revelation at Sinai, it marks the single greatest crisis during the wilderness years. So to understand Vayikra, we need to go back and examine closely the story of the golden calf. How important is this? You see, all of a sudden, we realize that this isn't just another book of rules. It's actually an essential digression for the people who've come out of Egypt to understand what this new paradigm, a paradigm that's going to create them as a holy nation and a royal priesthood, what that actually means. So look what he says at the bottom of page 7, this last paragraph. The story in broad outlines is straightforward. Moses ascended to Mount Sinai, and after a great revelation in which God spoke to the entire people, he had been absent for several weeks. The people, unsure of when and if he would return, panicked. Without Moses, how would they receive the will and the word of God? That, according to many commentators, is what the calf is. Not an idol, but an oracle, a point at which divine communication was received. How important is that? Because I can tell you, in all of my Christian training and in all of my academic career, I have never heard anybody talk about the golden calf as an oracle instead of an idol, right? Because we all think the golden calf was the first major sin of Israel because they went back to idol worship. But look what Sachs is pointing out. The idol had nothing to do with it. What they were really doing is requesting from Aaron a way to understand God's voice in the absence of Moses. They didn't know if he was coming back or not. He'd been gone 40 days up on the mountain. Who knows what happened to him? And they're saying to themselves, how can we go forward without direction? And so the calf becomes the vehicle by which they will receive God's instruction. Now, you would say, wait a minute, isn't that idolatry? Well, not exactly, because if you know anything about Greek philosophy, you know that an oracle, especially the one at Delphi, was critical for people to understand how they should behave. They would go to the Delphi oracle, present a sacrifice, ask a question. The oracle would, at some point in the future, respond to their question and direct their lives. So an oracle becomes, what did Indiana Jones say? A radio to God, right? That kind of thing. The reason that you have to have an oracle is because you don't want to go forward without understanding what God wants you to do. And now you've come out of Egypt. Moses has led you out to Sinai. You see this magnificent display of God's power at Sinai. You hear his voice. And then Moses disappears into the mountain. And of course, you can't go forward. You can't go back to Egypt. And you can't go forward without some kind of direct communication from God, and you don't have your leader anymore. So you go to Aaron and say, give us an oracle. Give us a way to hear God's voice. I think it makes such a huge difference in understanding why these people wanted a golden calf at this juncture. And of course, what Sachs is pointing out is that mistake. It wasn't a mistake of a return to idolatry. It was a mistake of not believing that God had engaged Moses in a way that wouldn't abandon them. That mistake caused all kinds of havoc later on, had all kinds of consequences, like the breaking of the first tablets, right? Disastrous mistake. But it wasn't based on a return to idolatry. It was based on a fearfulness that God would abandon them in the wilderness, right? Really, really important. I don't know if you recognized what critical difference that was when you got to page 7 there, but really, really important. Okay, so my next comment is on page 10. There's a couple of things at the bottom of that page. And here, I think Sachs moves in the direction of what later becomes a standard Christian theological declaration. So he says this, starts in the middle paragraph there. If this is what happened in Exodus 33, it is one of the most decisive moments in Judaism. It's difficult at this distance of time to realize how radical a break with the civilizations of the day monotheism was. He's talking about one God. The God of Abraham differed in two ways from the religions of the ancient world. First, he was transcendent. So I want to put a question mark there because I want to talk about that in a minute. He was beyond the universe because he created the universe. Absolutely. None of the gods worshipped by the ancients were remotely like this. Even Akhenaten, the pharaoh, whom some, most famously Sigmund Freud, identified as the first monotheist, thought it was the god of, thought that God was the sun. The sun was within the universe, not beyond it. And you can see that if you look at the ancient descriptions of Egyptian cosmology, you'll always see that they're within the shell of the universe. Okay. Second, God acted in history. That too had never been conceived before. For the ancients, the gods were in nature. They were in the rain, the river, the sun, the storm. In nature, time is cyclical. Things are born, grow, reproduce, and die, but nothing really changes. Things are as they are because that is how they were and always will be. With the Exodus, God changed history. Stop. Really important. Two things. First, let's go back to the transcendence claim. Okay. So Christian theology picks up this idea of transcendence, and it ultimately ends in Thomas Aquinas' Via Negativa. And you know the Via Negativa is that we, as created beings, are everything that is not God. Okay? So God is holy, we are not holy. God is pure, we're impure. God is sinless, we are sinful. God is omniscient, we are not omniscient, right? God is omnipotent, we are limited in our power. And it keeps going down that list until it gets to things like we are temporal, therefore God must be extemporal. Okay? And that's how we get to this idea of transcendent, that everything that we experience in our limited human world, God isn't. So he must be so different than us. In philosophy, it's called the holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y, the holy other. He must be so different from us that we can't even conceive of him because we have such limited cognitive abilities as human beings. Right? In fact, there's a strain of theology in the Reformed tradition which talks about the fall as a noetic sin as well as a volitional emotional one. Noetic means that sin, the first sin affects your mind so that you cannot actually think properly anymore. Okay? So this idea of transcendent in Sachs' view is that God is outside of the universe because he creates all the universe. That's great because that's where Genesis starts, right? Coupled with a statement in Isaiah, we finally get to the idea that God creates the universe. It comes into being, but God is not the being of the universe. Okay, but that idea gets extrapolated, gets embellished until we reach the Christian notion that God is so different from the universe that we can never really actually understand him. Okay, so I want to not let us think that Sachs is moving that far in his thinking. He's only saying that God is transcendent in the sense that he's not part of the universe. Outside isn't the right term. I don't want to use that term because it's a spatial one. But in terms of creation, God is not part of the universe. The pantheism is denied by this claim. Okay? Now let's look at the second part where he says, second, God acted in history. Okay. Why is that important? Because if you have a truly transcendent God, then there's nowhere to locate God within the universe, right? If he's truly transcendent, then he's completely other than the universe. And this is the dilemma of Christian theology. Because once it proclaims a strong transcendence, then it means that God doesn't actually have any connection with the universe. And we get that in the deist claim that God winds up the clock of the universe and just lets it go, that he's not part of it, okay? But Judaism didn't do that. Judaism said God created the universe, therefore he's not part of it. He's not the river, the sun, the moon, etc. But he acts in it, which means that he's immanent in the human condition. And you'll remember Abraham Heschel made a big point of this, because what he said is that the scriptures never actually tell us about the essence of God, which, of course, is what Christian philosophy was all about. Okay? What he says is the scriptures only tell us about God in relation to human interaction. And when you think about it, that's exactly right. There are no verses that tell you what the essence of God is. There are only verses that tell you how God interacts with us, human beings. So Sack's second point is the really important one, because what it does is it breaks this notion that God is completely other. And it says, we understand whatever God is, we understand him only in relation to how he acts in our history. Right? And consequently, notice that last part where he says at the end, God changed history. Well, he says more precisely with Exodus, God created history. And Merci Eliade, who has written a really, really good book you should read, it's called The Myth of Eternal Return, he makes this point that it was the Hebrew culture that actually invented the idea of history. Why? Because history is not just the sequence of events. History is the why of the sequence of events. And if the sequence of events is just an eternal return, that you just go around the lap and you come right back to the beginning again, then there's no real meaning to the sequence of events, right? If everything just happens over and over and over, which is what the ancient world was about, the Mayan calendar is 27,000 years in its cycle. You know, the Roman calendar was 1 year in its cycle. But the whole point is, it just keeps going around. We start over again. We have a new year, but it's actually not new. It's just the same things going around again, okay? If that's the only issue with the sequence of events, then nothing is actually really meaningful because it just gets repeated. It was the Hebrews who said, no, things might go around, but they have direction. We're going in the direction of a royal priesthood, a holy nation, and the redemption of the universe. The reconstitution of God's created universe. And because of that, there's a process, there's a destiny, there's a direction. And that creates the idea of history, right? Before history, there's only the sequence of repeating events. After history, there's the why the sequence of events occurs. So Sacks is absolutely right. Merci Eliade wrote a whole book about how the ancient world was changed. And that says something really, really interesting about where we are today. Because Eliade is also the guy who says that the modern man is the first human being to not have a direction. Okay? The modern man returns to the pagan ancient world where everything just repeats. So, from the modern man's non-religious perspective, there's no reason to do anything except just take advantage of whatever is in front of you. Because there's no destiny. There's no bigger picture. Right? Remember, Heschel talks about man's grasp must extend beyond his reach. There must be a purpose bigger than himself. But if I live in a cyclical world, there's no point in that. I might as well just take everything that I can get now, because there's no divine purpose for my being, right? So Jean-Paul Sartre, being in nothingness, Heidegger, being in time, Kierkegaard, all of these guys contributed to the idea that there's really no meaning at all to being in the universe, because everything is just the same again, right? And once, as Eliade points out, once we reach the point where we've exiled God from our society, that's what we're left with. So we just keep going around the circle. The circle might be bigger than 1 year, might be 50 years, might be 1,000 years, whatever it is, but there's no real meaning to it, right? And you can see this actually in Scripture. If you think about Ecclesiastes, what does Ecclesiastes say about the man who works hard to create a fortune to pass it on to his children? What does it say? He dies. The rich are buried next to the poor. The sage is buried next to the fool. He passes his treasure on to his next generation. They spend it. There's nothing left. What's the point? Right? What he basically says is death swallows up everything. Okay? So what Sachs is saying here is because God provided a meaning for the events, death no longer swallowed up everything. Really, really important stuff. If you don't see what's happening here in Leviticus, you can't understand even what the cross is all about, because the cross isn't about salvation. It's about a reminder to the population that death isn't the end, right? It's really, really cool to see that we have hints of this as far back as Leviticus. Okay, so now we're going to go to the next page. A really important point that he makes here about the creation of history. And, of course, the creation of history is a Jewish thing. They created this new idea in the world that had never been part of the world before. Okay, so he goes to the next page, number 11. The second paragraph. At the deepest level, that was what the crisis of the golden calf was about. At that moment, Moses was the sole connection between heaven and earth. Absent him, and there was terror. Yet, why did the problem surface then and not in the days of Noah? Some fundamental solution to the distance between God and man is language. Words alone have the power to cross the abyss between finite humans and infinite God. God spoke to Adam, Cain, Noah, the patriarchs, the matriarchs, and to Moses. And of course, from the perspective of the people, I must have somebody who can speak to me in God's words. And the prophets do that, right? So Moses is that connection, right? Now he says, a sentence about halfway through the next paragraph. Making of the golden calf was a mistake, a sin, but the crisis that led to it was real and enduring. Right? Real and enduring. That means it continues. We're still looking today for an intermediary between God and us because most of us don't hear directly from God. Right? We need that intermediary. So he says, what would become of the people in the absence of Moses or someone like him? How could a nation take the risk of depending entirely on God when God was so distant, overpowering, and unpredictable? And, of course, that's the transcendence issue, right? It shows up in Christianity as well, by the way. And what's really interesting in Christianity is the difference in the solution, okay? So in Judaism, the solution is the Mosaic Torah, the words of Moses that connect me to the voice of God, followed, of course, by the priest, which is what Leviticus is all about, and the prophets. Okay, how do I overcome transcendence? The same issue. How do I overcome transcendence in Christianity? Because if God is truly transcendent, then I need an intermediary, somebody who can speak to me of God's words. Okay, and you would think, oh, of course, Jesus, right? Jesus is the incarnation of God speaking to me in human terms, and now, of course, I have a bridge between God and man. And if you looked at any of the spiritual, you know, four spiritual laws kind of theology, that's the way they paint Jesus. The cross is the bridge between sinful man and the holy God. But think about what happened. The Trinity promoted Jesus to the point of the transcendent God. In other words, the doctrine of the Trinity removed the human Jesus from humanity and placed him in the heavens with the transcendent God. I can't hear from him anymore. He's disconnected from me, right? He's God on the cross. God is transcendent. So what can I possibly know? I mean, yes, of course, Christianity had to posit that he was both 100% human and 100% God, an absolute irrational solution, right? But you understand how difficult that was for Christianity, because they are faced with the same problem, a transcendent God. So what did they use to bridge that transcendence? And the answer is what you find in every Catholic church across Italy, a statue of Mary. Because if Jesus is God, I still need someone to bridge the gap, and Mary is human. Okay. Michael, you got your hand up. Give us some comments.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you're talking about oracles and spoken word and communication and Mary and Jesus. I wonder, you know, there's a prohibition, I think, in Leviticus against mediums, you know, in talking to the dead. Is that one reason that Judaism rejects Jesus? Because basically you're communicating with a dead man?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, they might see it like that. I'll have to ask Rabbi Zev if that's how Jews perceive. It wasn't Flusser's view. I think Jews generally perceive Jesus as a sage, or if they have a positive view, then he's a sage. And there are sages who provide us with godly wisdom, but that's different than a medium or an oracle. Now, you can prohibit mediums because they're supposed to be connected with the dead. But an oracle doesn't connect with the dead. An oracle is the voice of God live, okay? So, and that's really interesting because think about this. Let's go back into Genesis and see if there aren't oracles that actually show up in Jewish history. And the answer is yes. When? Okay? So what person in Jewish history consults an oracle to find out what in the world is happening? Okay? It's not translated that way, but in Hebrew it says that she consulted an oracle. Who would that be? Yes.
Yeah, witch of Endor.
No, that's a medium going to the dead, right? Who goes to an oracle for intercession? A live explanation of what God is doing. Lindy? Can't hear you. Your microphone's off. Still can't hear you. Your microphone's off. No?
Let me see if I can.
Yeah, okay. So the one who goes to the oracle is the wife who has two children fighting each other in the womb, right? Think about this, right? Esau Jacob, right? And it says that she was having so much difficulty with her pregnancy that she consulted an oracle to find out what was going on. Does that mean that she went to a medium to speak to the dead? No. She went to an oracle to hear God's explanation of what was happening in her womb. Right? That's how it's actually written in the Torah. Of course, we don't get that. We get the sanitized version, right, that says that she consulted God. But that's actually not what happened. Okay? So what's really interesting is, as Sachs would point out, right, in the past, God spoke directly to Abraham. He spoke directly to Noah. He actually spoke directly through an oracle to some of the matriarchs, right? So we would expect that. That's not a problem at all. But now we've reached a point where Moses is the only connection. So what happens when Moses can no longer speak, when Moses has apparently died on the mountain, right? Now I need an oracle, and I can't run off to a statue of Mary, so I ask Aaron to produce an oracle so that we will have the voice of God, right? Really interesting. Does that help answer that question, Michael? Yeah?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So now let's look at the bottom of page 11 where he says, God answered Moses' request with these words, let them make me a sanctuary and I will dwell in their midst. Exodus 25:8. Okay. So what does God do in order to handle the oracle question? He creates the tabernacle, so that he's going to be with them, right? really important. A very different view of the purpose of the tabernacle, too. This is the start of an entirely new relationship between God and the people. The verb to dwell had never before been used in relation to God. And you can go look that up in your lexicon. The root, Shekinah, means a neighbor, someone who lives next door, right? That is really, really important. Because look what's happened. We still have the same issue, transcendence and immanence. And what Sachs is pointing out is the answer to the golden calf is the tabernacle, right? Because the tabernacle doesn't depend on Moses. It's God saying, I will be present with you. You no longer have to fear that some singular leader in the absence of a singular leader, God has abandoned you. Nope, I'm right here. The Shekinah is now in the midst of the camp, right? Really important. So what have we discovered? A new understanding of the golden calf and a new understanding of the tabernacle. And suddenly this excursus in the middle of the narrative about the movement from Egypt to Canaan has taken on a really significant role because it explains what was going to happen to these people in terms of their reliance on and only on God. Right? Okay. Let's go to the next page. 12. Okay, he says in the middle paragraph, likewise, the sense of divine presence. The people could not see God's face or understand his ways, but they could experience his glory. It was this phenomenon, cloud-like yet radiant, that would dwell in the sanctuary, the symbolic home of God. There would be a series of regular encounters bringing sacrifices, though the Hebrew word korban is better translated as coming close by bringing close. The entire system of korbanot, and all that went with them was a response to the crisis of the distance of God. That is the story behind Vakera. Okay, so now we have a new view of what Leviticus is all about, right? What's the crisis of that creates the need for Leviticus? Transcendence. What is the solution? The tabernacle. What is the implication? A life of holiness spelled out by the priests so that I can draw close to God. So sacrifice is no longer a ritual of repentance. Sacrifice is now a way to draw close and overcome the barrier of transcendence. Right? Pretty cool. Okay. So he says on 13, hence, the unique task and mindset of the priest, his role was to protect and maintain boundaries. Excuse me. The fundamental act of the priest is to distinguish, separate, know where things belong and where they don't. In the bottom sentence, the priest is the guardian of the order in a world in which humans are always creating chaos. Only in an ordered universe can holiness survive. Well, we can emphasize that. We can underline that. We can also apply it. Because quite frankly, it fits exactly with what's happening today in a world exiled from God. Look what he says. Only in an ordered universe can holiness survive. The more chaos I have in the world, the more disorder, the less the presence of holiness. And boy, do we ever see that. I mean, this is as relevant as today's news. So, now let's put it in its historical context. God wants a nation of holiness, right? You should be a holy nation, a royal priesthood. How can that happen? It can only happen when I have order. How will I have order? When I know where the boundaries of what is sacred and what is profane, where I know where those boundaries are. If I don't know the boundaries, I can't understand how the order will be applied, and therefore I can't experience holiness. So Leviticus, the priest in Leviticus, becomes the one who provides me with the fence lines, the boundaries. Why? To create order so that holiness can be revealed, right? It's so cool because now we understand why you needed Leviticus in the middle of this narrative, right? You need Leviticus right after the experience of the terror of transcendence, which of course you saw on Mount Sinai. You know, the mountains covered in a thick cloud, the lightning, the thunder, it scares people to death because it's the transcendent God. But now I need a way to overcome that fear. The tabernacle provides it, and the priest becomes the interpreter of what holiness means. Okay? So, he says, Leviticus is written almost entirely in a priestly voice. It uses the vocabulary we encounter only rarely in the wisdom or prophetic voices. Alongside lehavil, the other key verb for the priest is leharot, to teach, instruct, deliver a judgment, make a ruling. It is from this verb that we get the noun Torah. Okay? So now, this is really interesting, because now what it tells you is I have to rethink what Torah is about, right? I mean, Torah is a narrative, of course. The central core of Torah is not the narrative. The central core is the instruction in boundary keeping so that order will prevail and holiness can be revealed. Right? Now, is it any wonder that as young children, Jewish instruction begins in Leviticus? How could it not? It's the fundamental book of order for the society, right? It's like reading the Constitution as a kid. The American Constitution is the fundamental document of American order, law and order. Leviticus is the fundamental document of Jewish law and order. Without it, you can't have a nation of holiness. You can't have a royal priesthood. You can't understand the direction of Jewish history. Right? Yes, Michael, you have your hand back up.
Nope.
No? Okay. All right. Do you see how critical this is? I mean, this introduction is amazing because it resets our whole thinking about Leviticus as another set of rules, right? It's not that at all. It's like the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States. It forms the very structure of the society and how it has to operate. Okay, let's go to the next page, 14. Top of the page. God is everywhere and every time, but we're not always conscious of him. Adam and Eve in Eden believed that they could hide. The continuing drama in the Hebrew Bible is of God's attention and human inattention. God is there, but we forget that he is there. Holiness is consciousness of the Shekinah in the midst of life. Wow, you can underline that one. Because what it really says is the Levitical order is about an attempt to increase our awareness of God's presence. Right? He's always present. We're the ones who are most of the time absent. And the Levitical order is an attempt to get us to have a greater sensitivity, a greater awareness to God's presence. Because in God's presence, holiness will prevail. We just have to remember what that is. Okay? So, he says on the next page, top of 15, when God sanctifies the Jewish people to become a holy nation, it has the same connotation as in marriage. That is, the people are designated by God to be exclusively his, to worship him alone. In this sense, monotheism is like monogamy, a one-on-one relationship between the people and God. Okay? You can underline that one and put in the margin, where in the world did the doctrine of Trinity ever come from? Because this statement means that there can't be another God, right? That idea has to come from someplace else. Okay, now he's going to define what it means to be holy. In the middle of the next paragraph, you see his comment about Rudolf Otto, the idea of the holy. Otto was one of those philosophers who tried to articulate the idea of transcendence, and he called it the mysterium tremendum, the tremendous mystery, the fearful mystery, right? He uses a book from Soren Kierkegaard, Fear and Trembling, as the basis for his discussion. And Sachs points out in this sentence, the holy is that in the presence of which one feels awe. And you can connect that directly to Abraham Heschel. Because Heschel's whole thing is, if you don't understand awe, you cannot understand the Hebrew God. Right? The whole basis of the Hebrew God is this idea of holiness. And holiness is that those moments when you are completely awestruck, when there's not a thing you can say, when the experience is so overpowering that it just pervades you, it destroys you, it dishevels everything about you. That's the experience that we're looking for. That's the experience of transcendence. Most of the time, we don't have that. So we need the intermediary of the Levitical priesthood to explain to us what holy behavior looks like in the absence of that overpowering sense of transcendence. I don't know if you've ever experienced that. I have a couple of times. I have had a few moments in my life where I was suddenly so overpowered it wasn't exactly emotion, but it was this sense that there was something, excuse me, other. I mean, I just wept. No reason. I just started crying. I just couldn't help it. And that sort of experience is so rare for most of us that we need a book like Leviticus to set the constitution of our society so that we don't lose track of who we are in relation to God when we don't have that kind of overwhelming experience. Okay? So he says, the bottom of this next paragraph, he says in an early article, Sacred and Profane, talks about Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik spoke about holiness. And then he says in the bottom of that, for Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the holy was that dimension within which all things found their unity within the unity of God and his infinite light. The secular is the world of separation, division, and conflict. To ascend to the holy is to see each object, person, discipline, and perspective as part of the whole, with its own integrity in the scheme of things. Therefore, all things secular can in principle be sanctified once we place them in the service of God, the unity that gives light and life to all. Okay? Why is that important? Because in typical Christian thought, there's the sacred and the profane, and never the two shall mix. Right? You dedicate yourself to a life of religious obedience, and that means you don't have anything to do with the external secular world. The difference between the convent, the monastery, and the marketplace. Okay? But that doesn't happen in Judaism. Look what he's saying. If we see how everything is held together by God's love for his creation, then every single part of the creation can, in principle, be an effective way to express holiness, right? Which means that even though we have distinctions like sacred and profane, it doesn't mean that an ox cart or a spoon can't be sacred. There's no ontological difference. It's only their function. And according to what Sachs has just said, I can functionally reconstitute anything in my life so that it becomes a means to the awareness of God. And that would convert it into a holy. Okay? We're going to see a lot of that as the priests start talking about what it means. Okay. So the whole question now is, now that we see what Leviticus is supposed to be all about, the real question now is, okay, so what are these priests going to do to tell us all this stuff when we have this God who, you know, we don't experience directly every day? In fact, we hardly ever experience that way. And we see on page 17, he talks about, Kabbalism. But there's a citation from Isaiah. "Truly," says Isaiah, "you are a God who hides himself." 45:15. And though Jewish mysticism is almost wholly a post-biblical phenomenon, did you get that? There is a basic insight here that is that accurately describes what is happening in the Torah's account of creation. Human freedom essentially exists, or especially exists, because of divine self-limitation. So Adam and Eve found that they were able to sin, and Cain even to commit murder, without God stepping in to intervene. Through voluntary self-restraint, God makes space for man. I'm going to continue. But there is a problem here, and it haunts the biblical narrative. What is the difference between a hidden God and no God? The very existence of the universe testifies to a concealment on the part of God. The word olam, universe, is semantically linked to ne'elam, hidden, visible. Humans could not exist at all. Why is that? Because if God were always visible, human beings would not be able to have free choice. There would be immediate, instantaneous judgment on every decision. So God pulls back in order to allow us to have free choice and summons us in love to make the choices that are in alignment with him. Okay? So he says, "No man may see me and live," says God. "If we continue to hear the voice of God, we will die," say the Israelites at Sinai. But if God is always invisible, hidden, imperceptible, then what's the difference does his existence make? It will always be as if he were not there. The answer to this dilemma is holiness. Holiness represents those points in space and time where God becomes vivid, tangible, and a felt presence. Holiness is a break in the self-sufficiency of the material world, where infinity enters space and eternity enters time. In relation to time, it is Shabbat. In relation to space, it is the tabernacle. These are, in Torah, the epicenters of the sacred. Okay? Now, I want to jump all the way forward to the apostolic material and say that there is a Greek word that does exactly the same thing here, right? That Greek word we've talked about before. And now I have to remind myself. So Chronos is the Greek word for the uninterrupted sequence of time. One thing happening after another. Remember the pagan sequence of events without meaning. Chronos, chronology, right? My watch, it just goes around and around and around, meaning nothing, okay? But Kairos is that Greek word that effectively summarizes exactly what he said here about the relationship between space, the tabernacle, and time, the Shabbat. Because Kairos is the slice of eternity that shows up in a moment of, in a sequence of chronos. And in fact, that's exactly how it's used in the gospel account. When Mark
you're breaking up. Hey, we can't hear you.
No, it's completely off. Shit. Okay. No, you can't hear me?
Better. We can hear you now.
Yeah, we can hear you now.
You can hear me now?
Perfect.
Must have Verizon. Can you hear me now?
Cairo.
Your video is frozen, so you may want to cut your video.
Holiness, is that... Is it...
It's choppy.
Moment. That... Yes.
Skip, when you started to talk about Mark, that's when we lost you.
Okay, so let me back up, and then because I'm going to lose the signal probably. Okay, so let me back up quickly. So in the Gospel of Mark, no, you don't hear it?
Yeah.
You can't hear it. Okay. In the Gospel of Mark, the translation English is in the fullness of time, right? And, of course, it's breaking up again. Okay. Let me know if you can hear me.
Skip, try turning off your video to see if that'll... give you more bandwidth.
I'd love to be able to turn off the video when I do that. Yeah, I don't know how to turn off the video on this thing.
On the bottom of your
camera,
screen.
Here we go. Yeah, camera settings. Turn off camera. Okay, so let's see if that helps. Okay, how are we doing?
Yep.
Okay, so this is the last point that we'll make for today anyway. So here's the point. In the Gospel of Mark, the English translation says, in the fullness of time, right? When it talks about the birth of the Messiah. That word is kairos in Greek. And what it means is a moment of eternity sliced into the normal chronology of our lives. In other words, it's the point at which transcendence actually shows up in our ordinary living, right? So that's exactly the same issue that Sachs is dealing with here. What's he say? Holiness represents those points in time and space when we actually see God's handiwork show up in our ordinary lives, right? Ordinarily, we're not aware of God's being because he's hidden. But there are moments when he shows up. And in the gospel accounts, one of those moments is the birth of the Messiah. Another moment is the baptism of the Messiah. That's when you see transcendence show up in chronology. So the Greek Gospels have the same idea of holiness built into their narrative. It's as though they also have a Leviticus excursus in the middle of the Gospel accounts of the life of Yeshua. Okay? So Sachs is right on. I mean, it's another indication that the Gospels are thoroughly Jewish because it's the same idea, right? Okay, we're at the end of the hour and my connection is not good at all, so I think we'll cut it off here. I know we didn't get very far, only 18 pages, but I don't expect that we'll finish this book. We'll just get a good start on it. So I hope you had some insights. I'm open to anybody's comment now, so we can finish this off with the remarks that you might want to make. So please, if you have something to add, please do that. No. Can you still hear me?
Yeah. Skip, this is Larry.
Yeah.
I want to say that I got a lot more out of this than I expected.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm more interested in looking into the Leviticus, I would say, at this point. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah, isn't it amazing that it changes the whole perspective of what Leviticus is about?
It's an exciting book.
Yes. Dennis, go ahead.
Yeah, it just makes you really understand that a government without the people being orderly will never work.
Yeah, that's right. That holiness can't survive in an unorderly world. And we see that around us all the time. We see it today. But it's interesting that that's exactly the point at which the golden calf shows up and exactly why you need Leviticus as this excursus of following the incident of the golden calf. Lindy, you had something to add?
I was just going to say when you were talking earlier about experiencing, Skip, you had a few experiences of experiencing that unexplainable feeling. But at the holiday of Yom Kippur, at the very end, and I don't know if anybody's ever been to a synagogue or experienced this, but at the very last service, you stand for over an hour. They say the gates are closing, but you have an opportunity to go up to an open ark wherever you are, all the Torahs are, and it's you and yourself, and maybe others up there, but it's just you and yourself in front of whichever, wherever you are, and all the Torahs, and there's no explanation of that depth of feeling that can take place at that one particular time.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because as we get into this book, Sacks is actually going to talk about what sacrifice is about. And when he does that, he actually touches on exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
As we will see. Yeah.
I was just going to say, that's kind of the difference between biblical and regular, you know, democracy, because democracy is messy.
If we live by the tenets of what's in Leviticus and the Torah, it's just bookends of a way to set up society. We would not need to, and I don't mean tearing the toilet paper and paper. I'm just talking about the tenets. We wouldn't need to worry about locking our doors.
Yeah. Well, of course, because God is setting up a society that's based in this idea of holiness. And if it's based in the idea, if you think of Leviticus as the constitution of Israel, then you can see how these behaviors so form the interactions of people in the society. Maddie, did you have something you wanted to add?
I about the experiences that you've had. I've had experiences, and I really never talk about it because I found on page 4 at the top, it says, how in a finite world can we relate to an infinite God who cannot be identified with any natural phenomenon, who can neither be seen nor visually represented. And I say, you cannot, that moment that you had, there's no way for me in language, in human language, which I can relate, because when I start saying it, then it the words does not represent what I saw.
Yep. Yeah, I understand that perfectly well. And I think that's really important, because here we have a population, an entire nation that's been called out of Egypt that has experienced that transcendence, and now they're in the common world. And of course, their great fear is we're never going to be able to understand the transcendent God again. He's so distant from us that we have no way to follow him.
Right? Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.